as it was pointed out sometime back, it is not merely the conditions of our mind that tell upon the nature of the success that we achieve in our efforts, but also the nature of the atmosphere in which we are living. Both these factors are to be taken into consideration. There is an old saying, tell me the books that you read and the company you keep, I shall tell you what you are. This is a very wise saying, full of meaning. What is it in your bedroom? From that we can find out what sort of person you are. Search out your bedroom properly. What is on your bed? What is around? What pictures are you hanging on the walls? What books are you keeping? What is on the shelf? What is in the almirah? All these will be an indication of the nature of your mind and the nature of your involvements. These are not silly matters or things unimportant, at least from the point of view of spiritual life. Because from the point of view of the spirit that we are, there is nothing insignificant in this world. Every little thing is taken into consideration in a very appropriate manner. To God at least, there is nothing unimportant. And the way spiritual is the way of God. And so every little bit of thought, feeling and action and atmosphere is a matter for deep consideration, because as a little finger kept on the nose can obstruct a huge sun from being perceived, as a minute sand particle can irritate your eye and prevent you from seeing anything, a so-called insignificant event, a so-called unimportant thing, something not cognizable by the public eye, can become a terrific obstacle on our path. Because even the smallest thing can assume a large proportion when the time for it comes. A little incident can separate thick friends. And even an international war can take place on account of a little tiny incident that has taken place somewhere in the corner of the world. So there is nothing unimportant or meaningless if we deeply consider these aspects of our life. A spiritual seeker is a person who takes everything very seriously. He does not cut jokes with anything. And the most serious thing for him is his own personal life and his connections with things, even if they are inanimate. The things that are around you need not necessarily be animate to disturb you. It is not merely human beings then that can disturb us. Even inanimate, inorganic substances can disturb us. But money itself is an inorganic substance. Can it not disturb our mind? So, the atmosphere in which we are living is not merely a human atmosphere necessarily, it is anything and everything. in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad and to a certain extent in the Bhagavad Gita also we are given some sort of an advice as to what kind of atmosphere we have to select for the purpose of the practice of yoga. It should be free from every kind of distraction. The place for your stay, for your lodgement, for your practice should be completely free from avoidable distractions. And what are the distractions? Anything that can stimulate the submerged desires. It is not that we are free from desires even when we are in a lonely place. Even inside the holiest of temples, the desires can work. But the things around may not be such as to be capable of digging up the inner feelings within us. There are objects outside which can evoke certain feelings and reactions from within us. Though the feelings are always there, the condition of our mind does not change. Essentially, even if we physically move from one place to another place, yet, nevertheless, there is a possibility of their getting accelerated or accentuated and pronounced, made to manifest themselves concretely outside by objects of sense. An object of sense is anything that you can see with your eyes, a sound that you can hear, something that you can touch, something that you can smell or taste, and so on and so forth. These objects can rouse up the hidden feelings of even a distant past. Impressions created in our minds by experiences of 20 or 30 years back can be roused up into action by a counterpart in the world outside. Everything is inside us in the form of a subtle groove, like the groove of a gramophone plate, or like the impression formed in a photographic film. It can be duplicated, triplicated, and so on. It can be relayed at any time. It is waiting for an opportunity. The purpose of the spiritual seeker is not to give an opportunity for these grooves to get relayed into action, or the films within to be duplicated, etc. They have to be kept unused for a long time. Now, to keep a thing unused is not necessarily to destroy it. It can be there for a very, very long time, and yet it cannot actively disturb you. The purpose of seclusion is not so much an attempt at dealing a death blow at our old impressions suddenly, which is an impossibility. But at least mitigating the intensity of these feelings within and making us pass at least a little time in peace, though this peace is tentative and not is a real peace, because as long as the enemies are lying hidden within, ready for action at any time, we cannot be said to be really in peace. Yet, when the enemy is not taking action, it is a kind of peace. In the place of sequestration, to which the yoga student resorts, many types of effort may have to be put forth. It is not merely a stereotyped routine of action that will help us much. Because while we are under the impression that the enemy is not visible in the front, he can strike us from the back. There is nothing visible in front of us, so we go headlong. Ahead, along on the path, with the notion that everything is clear, the path is open, there is no problem, no difficulty. But the difficulties are created by certain placements of forces of nature which are spread out everywhere, and they are not always in front of us, physically speaking at least. The forces which we have to confront in the practice of yoga are in all 10 directions. They cannot be said to be only in front of us so that we can see them with open eyes. And we can also not say that because they are not visible in front, they are not there at all. An all-round action has to be taken in the practice of yoga. All the avenues have to be blocked so that there is no chance of an entry of these inimical forces at any time. How many passes and bypasses are there through which these forces can gain an ingress into us? These have to be known first. There is no use taking a sudden step. Because, as we have learnt earlier, the taking of the active step is not the real problem. The problem is the equipping of ourselves with all the necessities for taking that step. And that takes all the time, almost the major part of one's life. But that is not a loss of time. It is not a waste of energy. It is a necessity. Because when you have properly strengthened yourself, and you are confident of your strength, then to take the needed step would be very easy. What are the avenues or the channels through which the inimical forces can attack us? Broadly speaking, these are the senses. Though this is not a complete answer to the question, because there are more things to be said about these things. But generally, for practical purposes, we can say that the channels of approach for every kind of force are the channels of the senses. The mind has hidden potentialities which can be roused into activity through these avenues called the senses. The mind acts through the senses. Sometimes it can take direct action also, but it does very rarely. Mostly it acts through the senses. And it waits for an opportunity for the senses to act. And the senses act when they find an object which can stimulate them into action. Any sight can stimulate us into manifesting a hidden mental potentiality. And so on and so forth in respect of other sense organs also. So the student of yoga chooses to live in such a place or an atmosphere where objects are not in the immediate vicinity in order to rouse the senses into action. This step that the yogi takes in the beginning is no doubt not a solution to his problems. Because, as you know very well, that the submerged desires of the mind are not going to keep quiet for long like this, merely because they have no opportunity to express themselves. Yet, this is one necessary step. What is to be done with these submerged desires, we shall see later on, when they are not actively working. The system of yoga prescribes methods of dealing with them in an effective manner later on. But to live in a place of isolation for a long time requires some sort of strength already. A very weak person cannot live in isolation. The weakness of our personality is mostly due to our dependence on many factors outside, especially social factors, without which we seem to be incapable of conducting ourselves in our life or even existing. We have many needs of our body and mind, and these needs cannot be provided if there is no proper social atmosphere. And that is why most people cannot live in seclusion. Even a cup of tea you cannot get in seclusion. Not to talk of other things. It is a horrible state of affairs to contemplate the condition of a starved mind, which will feel as if heaven has come upon it, even if the least satisfaction is provided to it, if only it has been starved for a very long time. A drowning person is ready to catch even a straw that is floating on the surface of water, though he knows that the straw cannot save him. There is a starvation of the mind and the senses when we live in seclusion. And a famished personality is not always a healthy personality. So in the beginning it will look that we are deteriorating and becoming a sort of neurotic elements. And these peculiar features which can be projected outside on account of the starvation of the mind and the senses can make us look up within ourselves, and this awkwardness may put us out of order. If proper guidance from a spiritual adept is not forthcoming to utilize this condition for a better purpose, if positive spiritual guidance is not forthcoming, pure, forced and willful isolation would be of no use. Beginners, novitiates, youngsters would be taking a very foolish step if they imagine that they go to jungles or forests in the very beginning itself and search for God in the woods by a withdrawal of themselves from social contact and the starvation of the mind and the senses. They will go crazy because they have no positive spiritual guidance. After cleansing the personality through austerity, a form of which is isolation, seclusion, etc., the personality has to be filled with positivity. It is an absence of this positivity of approach that creates a sense of vacuum in oneself, often in spiritual life. We feel as if we are empty inside. And a vacuum is a dangerous place because anything can enter it. We are under the impression that vacuum will be filled by God, but that is not always the case. Even the devil can occupy that vacuum. Mostly that is what happens. God will not come. We have the story of Amrita Manthana, the Puranas, the churning of the ocean for the purpose of the immortal nectar of the celestials. Nectar did not come. What came was poison, deadly and frightening, darkening, repelling, which can drive you out of your senses. Such was the thing that came out when the gods churned the ocean for the purpose of an immortal ambrosia. No ambrosia came. And when we are churning the whole of existence in our spiritual practices for the sake of the nectar of immortality, that immortality will not come. Something the opposite of it will come. And then what will happen to us? We will be finished forever. We will be swept out of the ground. And it looked that we are in a state worse than the one in which we were even in earthly life, in a worldly life. The retracing of steps from the spiritual direction that one has taken earlier is a common feature among spiritual seekers. They turn back upon the very same condition of life which they were leading earlier. Sometimes they fall even further down. The earlier state would have been better. Because the facilities of austere living provided in a solitary place has not been taken advantage of by doing something positive. Here, we would also draw a line of caution. We must be very wise in choosing the kind of seclusion intended for the type of mind that is ours. Everyone is not in the same level of evolution. If a person comes from Delhi and stays in Shivananda Ashram, it is a kind of seclusion for him. But he may not be prepared to live in Badrinath. That will be an unsuited type of seclusion for a person living in Chandni Chowk or Connaught Place. So there is also a difference in the kind of seclusion on account of the degree of its intensity. Even in Delhi itself, if you go to the suburbs, that will be a seclusion for a person who is in Chandni Chowk. If you are in the middle of city of Bombay, to go to the outskirts of it in greater Bombay, that is a seclusion. But that is not such a seclusion as to live in Gangotri. That is something quite different. The extent or the intensity of seclusion that one can tolerate, and that would be essential for a person, should be judged by oneself if possible, by self-analysis. And one should not take extreme steps. Extreme is a danger. It will immediately bring about a retaliation that is undesirable. So while the choosing of seclusion should be in the proper intensity and not be of an extreme type, Even the Buddha failed in his extreme tapas. And he came down to what he called the middle path, or the Madhyama Marga, the Vaya Media, the golden mean of approach. And we should not go to extremes. An extreme is that step which the body and the mind in the present condition cannot bear. And that step should not be taken. Your intention is not merely to die or perish. A soldier, when he enters the battlefield, does not go merely to die there. That is not his intention. The purpose is to win victory in the war. The soldier does not say, let me go and die there. That is not the purpose. So we don't go to the spiritual path merely to perish. That is not the purpose. We go to win victory. And you can win victory only if you know all the tactics and techniques of warfare. You must be well trained in soldiering, in the art of battle. And you must have the suitable equipment with you. You must be healthy enough. You must have greater strength than the strength of the enemy. This is very important. Otherwise, victory will be far. Now, to judge whether you have a greater strength than the strength of the enemy is also a difficulty. You require guidance here again. And to know this, you must know who is your enemy first. Then only you can know whether your strength is greater or not. You should not think that the entire creation is before you to press you down into a state of defeat. The whole of creation is not being confronted at once. We are rising gradually from the immediate atmosphere to a larger expanse of it gradually. The whole world is taken into consideration afterwards. The immediate concerns of life are what we have to confront. Confronting means solving a problem, not merely facing it with the power of will to crush it down. We are not going to cut the Gordian knot, but untie it gradually. Because our problems are knots, ties, heaped up one over the other. And you cannot simply crush it. Because knowledge is not merely an expression of brute force, but a very intelligent extrication of oneself from involvements. The nature of knowledge is very peculiar, and the practice of yoga is a rise from one stage of knowledge to another stage. Every stage in the practice of yoga is a state or stage of knowledge, understanding and conscious experience. It is not a brute activity. It is not an unconscious dealing. It is not something that we do unawares. Every step is a conscious step. It is intelligently taken. And it is nothing but a movement of our mind in a sattvic condition. Yoga is a sattvic activity of the mind when it is already freed from rajas and tamas. So, right from the very beginning, we have to be cautious and do not allow ourselves to be fired up with any unnecessary enthusiasm. Sometimes a kind of jubilation enters us, which is bereft of understanding. That is improper. Mere enthusiasm will not succeed. Understanding is to be there behind it. Because while enthusiasm and a sense of confidence within is absolutely essential, it should not be a foolish sort of enthusiasm. Fools rush in where angels fear to tread, we are told. Angels will be afraid of going there and fools are rushing into it. We should not take such steps. It is because of this foolishness on our part, an unintelligent enthusiasm sometimes with which we are fired up. Because of this it is that we are failing in our attempt. Not only in the practice of yoga, but in every other walk of life, even in secular fields. We lack proper understanding and capacity of adjustment. We always go to the extreme in our thoughts, feelings and deeds. So, we come to the point again that the first thing that we have to do is to understand where we are standing. Where do I stand today? What is my physical strength? What is my moral strength? What is my intellectual capacity? What is my capacity to understand my relationship with other people? And what are the reactions that are likely to be set up by any step that I take, even the first step? If the reactions are set up, what further step I am going to take to set it right? Without getting defeated, of course. These are intelligent analysis which would precede your direct practice of yoga, commencing with asana, pranayama, etc. Hari Om Tat Sat.